We have some semblance of a partial budget. Today, we'll hear reaction from a variety of interest groups, none of whom say they're satisfied with the result. But also to get you ready for the long weekend.
You lived through all these years.
Yes.
You know when things will happen.
Happy 38th! No, happy.
Not me yet.
Let's get one more drink.
You don't have to.
I want to.
The time has come to select one courageous young man and woman for the honor of representing District 12 in the 74th Annual Hunger Games.
Those are screen adaptations of Outlander, Something Borrowed, Hunger Games. The books made our latest summer reading list. We're calling it our Guilty Pleasures list to kick off the holiday weekend. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a great 4th of July holiday show for you, but first, a quick news update. It took almost to the last possible moment, but the stopgap budget plan signed by Republican Governor Bruce Rauner last night partially closes out the fiscal year that ended yesterday. It includes spending for government operations through December. Governor Rauner has always said that schools are his top priority. In the stopgap plan, most services get just 6 months of funding, but pre-kindergarten through high school grades will have money for the entire year. State colleges and universities will see about $1 billion. The measure also gives funding to human services providers that didn't get any state money in the past year. At a media briefing yesterday afternoon, Governor Rauner thanked Republican lawmakers for doing what he called an outstanding job standing up for Illinois taxpayers. Despite the compromised short-term budget, the governor called this a small step towards making Illinois strong and healthy. Union groups, like the Service Employees International Union, blasted the governor. Here's SEIU Healthcare Illinois President Keith Kelleher.
The stopgap budget, it's just a Band-Aid for the self-inflicted wounds that Bruce Rauner himself has caused in Illinois. Home health agencies that shut their doors for good. Rape crisis centers, addiction services. God forbid you have any mental health issue and don't have insurance. Violence prevention programs. And it just shows that all of this human suffering that he has caused was avoidable. He was using working families. He was using children. Seniors and people with disabilities who are denied home care as human hostages so he can extract some political concessions that had nothing to do at all with the welfare of the people of Illinois.
There is still no so-called grand bargain. Democratic lawmakers and Governor Rauner have been unable to agree on a full budget deal as they're divided on controversial changes the governor wants. Gregory Bays is the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association.
The real long-term systemic problems of this state have not been addressed. And I think my members, the members of the manufacturing sector of this state, are still looking for this state government to address some of those problems, whether it be the pension issue that looms over everyone's head, whether it is the continued out-of-balance budget that we have seen pass in the past, spending more money with $11 billion of unpaid bills, to needed reforms in areas like workers' compensation that would make Illinois more competitive with our neighboring states. Those problems have not really been addressed here, and that's why we were somewhat dismayed by the way this all came about in the last 30 to 45 days.
As he said, the stopgap budget didn't have any of those changes attached. John Bowman is president of the Chicago-based Shriver Center on Poverty Law. He's also chair of the Responsible Budget Coalition, a group of more than 250 organizations throughout the state.
Passing a stopgap is very welcome and desperately needed, but nobody should be deceived about whether it's a fully funded, full-year responsible budget. We have to address the revenue side of the budget so that we have the money to pay for the promises we're making. We have never in this state put together an adequate revenue system to pay for it and to make smart investments like pre-K and preventive health care and things like that, where with a modest upfront investment, you can get long-term savings and better results for people.
The timing of the deal, as everyone likes to say, kicking the can to the end of their year, means lawmakers won't have to make any tough decisions on cuts, revenues, or some combination of both of them until after the November election. Todd Meisch, president and CEO of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, says that's a lot of uncertainty. And while this is an acceptable short-term solution, the state cannot afford the status quo.
While I think there's a consensus that this is a fine short-term outcome, the long-term problems Illinois faces still have to be addressed, and we will continue to encourage the governor and people who recognize the status quo is unacceptable to make those changes and press for those changes going forward. We talked to a lot of legislators on both sides of the aisle, Democrats, who know that the status quo is not acceptable. I don't care if you're far left or far right or in the middle. Nobody's happy with the status quo, yet that is what House Democrats, their leadership, have been defending. That's unacceptable, and that's why we're going to continue to press for changes.
Next week, we're going to be checking in with some social service agencies and school districts that have already been on the 21st talking about what they wanted to see how they feel about what's happened in the past 24 hours in the Statehouse. This Friday, maybe like all of us here at the 21st, you maybe want a break from the news of the world in our state, especially as we head into the 4th of July holiday weekend. So we thought we would send you off with some fun reads. All summer, we've been talking to librarians and hearing your suggestions to create some summer reading lists. We started things off with a generalist. A few weeks ago, we did kids' books, and today, well, let's just call these guilty pleasures. I feel like we should acknowledge this entire conversation we're about to have is predicated on being a book snob, which I am not. But many of us have people in our life who are, or maybe just read highbrow literature. So call these books that you want to read on your Kindle because you don't want those people to see the cover. Maybe they won't make you a better person to read, but hey, they're fun, which I think counts for something. And who better to do this with three student librarians from the University of Illinois School of Information Science. We reach out to the student chapter of the American Library Association here in Urbana, and three of their board are here in studio with me today. So I want to welcome Rachel Brandel, who's the treasurer, Jesus Espinosa, who's vice president, and Anna Lapp, who's the social media manager of the ALA student chapter at the University of Illinois. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Can you all start by telling me, Rachel, can you tell me what you're studying and what you plan, what kind of library work you want to go into?
Well, my focus is international librarianship, which just means that everything I think about has a little bit more of an international scope. The dream job is to someday work in an embassy or consulate, helping getting information for delegates and other professionals that come our way.
Jesus, what about you?
My focus is in digital preservation or data curation, and ideally I'd like to work in kind of that department within an academic library.
And Anna, how about you?
I'm focused on public librarianship, specifically youth services. So I'm looking at either children or teens jobs.
And do you guys, I wonder what it's like when you are in a program, in a graduate program with a lot of librarians. Is everybody talking about books they've read all the time?
Almost all of it.
Yes. Or how you don't have as much time as you thought you did to read all the books.
Yep. Your books that you want to read for fun.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Because no one in graduate school has time to read
exactly.
for fun. Right. I remember very clearly in graduate school, I never had time to read for fun. Then as you guys put this list together, I love this list because there's a lot of books on here that I've read. And we should say to everybody who's listening, we're crowdsourcing these as well. So if you have suggestions for us, first of all, you can tweet us. 21STShow is our handle. You can call us right now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us to books@21stshow.org, and we're going to add that to the list. On our website right now, you can see the list that our librarians here have put together. We're going to tweet that list out as well if you want to follow along with us as we're going through. What I love about this is, first of all, how would you guys describe, because I think everyone has a different opinion of what a guilty pleasure is. So, Jesus, what do you think is, how would you describe a guilty pleasure book?
I think it's anything you would say. If someone asks you what your favorite book is or your favorite movie is, it's like, it would come to the top of your head, but it's like, maybe I should hold back from saying that out
loud. I shouldn't say The Princess Bride. I should say something else. Is that okay? Anna, what's your definition?
Yeah, I think it's something that if someone asked you, you'd be a little bit embarrassed about, but you secretly just love it.
And Rachel, how about you?
I have to agree with what they've said. It's anything that maybe other people have preconceived notions of that maybe they would look at you a little bit differently, and you don't want that to happen.
So when we say that, if you guys can tell me now, if you can share with all of us what your favorite book is of all of those. Anna, can we start with you? Like, what's your favorite book that's sort of a guilty pleasure that maybe didn't even make it on this list?
Hmm. I'm not sure about that didn't make it on this list, but I have started Outlander, and I heard that purely because it's like kind of in the vein of like Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey, a book where everyone's like, ooh, it's a little bit saucy. But that's definitely one that I started, and it's pretty fun.
Yeah, Outlander does not have any vampires.
Nope.
And I think Outlander's actually really interesting. Outlander's on this list. I read Outlander a really long time ago before it became, I think, popular. But I think it's an interesting book because it kind of defies categorization. I think it gets pushed into romance, and I feel like that might be a little unfair. Rachel, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, actually, I talked with a friend who is a very huge fan of that book, and she said the author is very diligent in saying that it's not a romance, actually. It's actually a historical fiction.
So Diana Galbadon is the author of Outlander. It is now a TV series on Starz. The second season is actually, I think, wrapping up this week. The season finale, I think, is this weekend. And it's really interesting because a lot of fans of the book, just like when books get made into TV series like Game of Thrones, this is, I think, a good equivalent with Game of Thrones because there's so many. There's how many are in the Outlander series? There's like 7 books, right?
There's a lot.
And Anna, you've only read the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel, have you read some of them?
I just finished the second one. I'm starting the third.
So the second one is that Dragonfly and Amber?
It is.
So for people who have never heard of this, how would you describe the series?
Oh, that's a really hard question. It's a love story, but it is also historical.
Through time.
Exactly.
There's science fiction because she's a time traveler. I felt like I'd add that in.
It is very Romeo and Juliet. It is, you know, she was married in the present time, and then she becomes married to her lover in the 18th century, and she's torn between what she should do. And in the second book, she actually comes back. She raises a child, and it's very interesting because it shows the love life and the kind of sex life of a middle-aged woman, which is really unique. So it's really hard to categorize it.
Well, there's also so much history in all of these books. Like, this is takes place during the time of the Jacobite uprising, the rebellion with Scotland and England, and it's sort of like the beginning of the end of Scottish independence. And there's lots of detail, and there's a lot of history in these books because later on she goes through different, right? Do they end up in America in the second book, right before the revolution?
Third.
I think the third book. Sorry, I've given it away for people who haven't gotten there. But that's a really good one. Okay, so that's Outlander. Jesus, you had a book on this list that you really enjoy. It's called If Only by Jerry Halliwell. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So growing up, one of my biggest obsessions was like the Spice Girls and kind of that whole phenomenon.
Oh, it's that Jerry Halliwell.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Ginger Spice.
Okay.
So reading that, just kind of seeing what it was like for her growing up and then kind of the actions that led to her auditioning and being part of the group and their history and how they like rose to fame.
And so this is an autobiography.
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of, and I mean, when, apart from being a Spice Girls fan, are there, and you're kind of learning about her life, if you weren't a fan, are there other things in here that people would find interesting?
Definitely. So she grew up very, very poor. Her family life wasn't always very stable. So just seeing kind of that perspective of like what gave her like certain outlooks in life growing up. She dealt with bulimia growing up and then during the Spice Girls and after. So there's a little bit of everything, and it's not just, it's a fun book to read, but there's also a lot of depth to it.
Do you find that when we're talking about guilty pleasure books, I don't know about you guys, but do you find that they often make you cry? Nobody cries when they read these books. I feel like this is my definition of guilty pleasure. It's like the time traveler's wife. You're just sort of, I cry when I read books, which is kind of an embarrassing thing because I normally read on a plane. And then I'm kind of in a corner, like trying not to cry while I'm reading my book. Do you agree with me, Anna?
Yeah, but I think I'm an emotional reader. I cry over everything. But definitely, because guilty pleasures are kind of like tapping into your emotions because they're trying to make you feel the highs and the lows. So I definitely agree.
If you have suggestions for us that you want to add to the list as we're going through, we've got a great list of books here from the student chapter from the American Library Association, but you can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your suggestions as well to 21st Show. We're going to take a break in a couple minutes, but before we get to that, let's do one more. A lot of these, I think, Rachel, let's talk about the Shopaholic series because that's one you picked. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, my goodness. It is a roller coaster. It is about Becky Bloomwood, Rebecca Bloomwood. She is She is a 20-something woman. She has a job, but her goal in life is shopping. It's her addiction.
She's also a journalist. She's a quasi-journalist, I would like to say, based on me being a journalist and judging her life. But go ahead.
But she loses her job, and she actually gets a job in a financial company, and she writes articles about how to save money and how to explain saving money to women. And so she becomes known for explaining this to women, and suddenly she has to hide the fact that she's incredibly in debt, but she can't help shopping more, and when she feels bad, she shops more. And it's just, it's a great book for explaining addiction, and it's hilarious. Every single chapter, you'll have to put it down and just laugh.
Yeah, and I think it's a good example of sort of British chick lit, right? Because
exactly.
She's in London. Of course, there's a love story that's also involved with it. What do you like the most? I guess I'm wondering, like, what do you think is the best part of the series? Is it the shopping, or what do you think is it?
The best part is how she tries to get out of her problems. She is so ostentatious and just over the top. Like, she tells her boss that she can speak, I think it was Portuguese. And so they go to a group function with all these people. And lo and behold, some Portuguese people come up and they're totally ready for her to talk. And instead of actually, like, talking or just, like, saying she has a sore throat or something, she actually slaps one of the Portuguese businessmen. And it turns out that they actually like her because of it. It's hilarious.
It's very Bridget Jones Diary, right? And
yes.
I don't know which one came first. I'm guessing that this one came after Bridget Jones Diary, right? And the Shopaholic, there's actually a series. Are there three of them now, I think?
There's actually, I think, more like
there's
seven
more than
or
that?
Eight.
Oh,
there's
wow.
a ton. She actually had a baby.
Oh, right. So, and did these get made into TV? These are all, I feel like a lot of these books are all good candidates for movies. Did this get made into a movie? Jesus,
they
it did?
Made The Shopaholic into a movie.
Oh, they did. Okay. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about our summer reading list. Fun reads for you this holiday weekend. That was a Shopaholic series by Sophie Kinsella. If you have other suggestions, you can join us as well. Tweet us to 21st Show, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This 4th of July holiday weekend, we're getting you ready for reading. If you are going to be traveling this weekend or if you have some time to read, it's a third in our series of summer reading lists that we're doing. And in studio with me are three people from the board of the American Library Association student chapter at the University of Illinois, Rachel Brandel, Jesus Espinosa, and Anna Lapp. And just a note, full disclosure, we do, the 21st does get support from the university library system. So just a note to our audience to know that. If you have suggestions or want to join us in our guilty pleasure reading list conversation, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. I feel like as I'm looking at this list, and you guys have, there's 14 books on the adult reads, and then you have a YA section that we're going to get to also. A lot of these fall into the vampire category, which I think fits really well for, that's a good question. Like, is there a vampire book that would not be a guilty pleasure reading that you guys can think of?
Anything by Anne Rice.
I was going to say, I feel like Anne Rice is just more legitimate, but there's still sort of an element there.
Right. That's a good point, Anna. Rachel, you picked Incubus Dreams. It's from the Anita Blake series by Laurel Hamilton. What's that about?
It is all about Federal Marshal Anita Blake. She is a part of the Preternatural Unit, which means she hunts vampires and werewolves and the like. There's a lot of ties between the problems that have happened in the LGBTQ community, and they kind of relate those to what happened with the vampires and werewolves. So it's a very unique way of looking at a lot of issues, but it's The book is incredibly sexy. Anita suffers from something called the ardor, which she gets from her vampire lover. And basically, it makes her want it all the time, essentially. And she has to have it. She draws energy from it. So suddenly, she has all of these men in her life. And she never wanted to be like that. She wanted the white fence and the husband and the two kids and the dog. And she has a dog now, but it's a werewolf. So
okay, that's great, of course.
So it's a great look at polyamorous relationships. It's a really great look at it.
That's Incubus Dreams, and it's from the Anita Blake series. So there's a whole series.
Oh, yes.
Okay, there's another book that, Anna, you wanted to pick. It's called Plain Fear Forsaken. Anna, can you tell us about that?
Yes. So this book is interesting because it's like vampire meets Amish life. And the funny story about how I read it is that
you have the entire control room is laughing right now. Yes. I think we finally got some people. I think that some of them are going to read this book. Keep going.
Oh, you got to read it. It's perfect guilty pleasure. But so I'm from Ohio, and like once a year or maybe twice a year, my mom and I go to the Amish country, and we stay in this nice little cabin, and they have like their sort of own collection of books. And I found this in here, and it was signed by the author because she had stayed there. So she's like, she actually does know a lot about Amish life. So it's an accurate depiction of the Amish lives. But what happens is, so in the Amish lifestyle, kids have the option of when they're about 15 to take a year off and spend life in with modern conveniences. And so there's a guy that does that named Jacob, and he never comes back. He mysteriously dies, and he was in love with a girl named Hannah. So Hannah is constantly pining for him, but she's supposed to let him go. And on the other side, Jacob's brother, Levi, is in love with Hannah. And
there's
then,
always a love triangle.
Exactly.
Guilty pleasures.
Right?
Yes. I see common themes here.
No, definitely. And but then mysterious things start happening, and it seems as if Jacob's coming back for Hannah, but in a different form. So, and I think the nice thing about this book is the vampires are evil. So it's like evil vampires meets Amish life.
Okay. Continuing our vampire theme, you all included YA novels in here. Jesus, I think, why did you include YA novels in our list of guilty pleasures for adults?
I think they kind of have that perception of being a guilty pleasure, and sometimes they're not given as much credibility when people are reading YA novels.
Do you think that's fair?
I don't think it's fair at all. I think they're enjoyable. There's a lot of like lessons to be learned. There's a lot of really great things in them. And it's just about what audience they kind of appeal to.
So you all did not. There's no Harry Potter or Twilight mm-hmm. on this list, but you have the Vampire Academy series. Who picked that one? Rachel.
Yes, that is Harry Potter meets Twilight. It is a fantastic book about a vampire boarding school. And these vampires actually have access to magic and they can control elements. But this story is actually about a girl known as a Danfer, which is a half-breed. And it's essentially like you can kind of think of it as like the horse and mule type thing. So she doesn't have any of the powers that the other vampires have, but she does have big strength. And what ends up happening is she gets in a really horrible accident, and suddenly her and her vampire companion are intertwined in a spiritual area, and suddenly the vampires figure out that they have access to another element known as spirit, and it throws the entire vampire world crazy.
Out of balance. This was made into a very bad movie that I have seen.
I
actually did not finish. So the book is better, is what you're saying. If someone has happened across this movie, this is a much better book.
So much better. It's 100 times better than Twilight. I won't say Harry Potter because I love Harry Potter, but it's definitely better than Twilight.
What I think is really interesting is we're talking about whether it's vampire or science fiction. It's really interesting how you all are seeing themes in this book. Whether it's to sort of maybe talk about issues that are kind of people dealing with sort of modern day diversity or minorities, or as you were saying, LGBTQ issues. Is that kind of, it's an interesting thing. Do you think that the writers are intending this when they're writing them? Or do you think you guys are, I'm curious about that. Jesus, what do you think?
I think at least in most cases it's intentional, and there has to be some kind of thought to what this may represent to a certain group of people. And sometimes it really is good to have something to identify with. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not specifically saying this is for an LGBTQ audience, just having something that they can sort of relate to.
One other genre that we haven't talked about is historical. And we kind of got into that with Outlander. Anna, there's a book you're reading right now. It's called Nine Women, One Dress by Jane Rosen, and that's actually going to be released in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be released on July 15th. It's interesting because it's also a vignette story, so it's like it will follow different characters, but it will like leave them, then pick up with another character and come back. And the idea is the book starts off with this model who's completely young and is no one knows who she is, and she's wearing like the dress of the season that everyone loves, which is a little black dress. And what's neat about the book is it weaves this really popular dress into normal people's lives and how it affects them. So there's like a girl that works at Bloomingdale's and how it changes her life. So it's definitely interesting and sort of like that weaving the different stories.
Oh, right. And this one isn't historical. This is set in modern day.
Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks for that one. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I like it a lot. I'd recommend it.
Who picked Jemima J by Jane Green is on this list. Rachel, you want to talk about that one?
That is another hilarious book. I love it when they're funny. Jemima is a worker in England, and she is about 100 pounds overweight. And she's always been that way in her life. Everybody walks over her. They treat her awful. And she ends up one day, one of her friends actually takes her face and puts it on a picture of a skinny model. And they realize that she could actually become very skinny. Well, this book was written about the time internet chat rooms and stuff were becoming really popular. So what essentially happens is they post that picture online and she finds this hunk from California. And this guy really wants to meet her and he's great. And so she commits herself and loses all of her weight and becomes a size 2, which I thought was amazing because there's so many books about overweight women that they kind of learn to like love themselves without going through the change. And I think there's a whole group of women out there who's gone through the change and then realized that maybe losing that weight wasn't what was going to make them happy.
And that's what this is about.
Yes.
That's really interesting. Going back to the Amish theme, there's another book, The Secret Keeper by Beverly Lewis. Anna, do you want to talk about that one?
I think
Rachel,
Rachel's
did you pick that
one
too?
Yeah.
Oh, Rachel, sorry, you picked that one too. Go ahead, Rachel.
Well, that is my biggest guilty pleasure is I love Amish books. I mean, I know all they
I didn't know this was a category.
I know they build barns, they make quilts, they churn butter. I mean, it's exciting stuff. It's great.
Tell us about The Secret Keeper.
It's about an Englisher girl, which they refer to the rest of the world as Englishers.
Ah, okay. People who are not Amish.
Yes. It's an Englisher girl who decides that she wants to join the Amish community, which is something that never really happens in their walk of life. But she is very dedicated. And so she comes with this idea that the Amish world is perfect. And it turns out she finds out slowly that they're not perfect and they make mistakes like everybody else. And she finds that out by becoming everybody's secret keeper. And
So that's exactly what it means, right? Everyone starts telling her their secrets?
As she kind of stumbles upon them, yeah, and she realizes that people aren't following the rules of the Ordnung, which is the set of guidelines and rules that the Amish people follow. And she questions whether she wants to join this community, whether the community really wants her. And it's just another great book by Beverly Lewis, who writes a ton of Amish books.
Okay. So let's go to the YA novels on here. We talked about one of them, which was Vampire Academy, because that was kind of in our vampire. What other ones? There's also a whole class, and I think it's really interesting. There aren't very many. You guys didn't pick very many dystopian books in here. Oh, there's one, Survivor. Who picked Survivor?
That was actually picked by our president, Alex Kinnaman.
Okay.
It's actually by the same author that wrote Fight Club.
Ah, okay. So this is not a dystopian.
I have not read it, so okay. I don't think it is. Okay, right. Sorry.
So this is this is a story of Tender Branson, who's the last survivor of a Creedish cult. Okay, interesting. But for dystopian, I don't know if this is dystopian, the Selection series.
Yeah.
Anna, what do you think?
I think you could count it as dystopian because it is like they live in a broken system world.
What are these books about?
So it is a series. The premise is that these people live in a caste system of 8 different castes, and a girl that's in the 5th caste, which is considered like lower end, gets selected for something called the Selection, which is basically like a bachelor for the prince of their land.
So it's like the Bachelor reality show.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's why I said, and it's actually been described by this, I think, by Publishers Weekly as sort of like Hunger Games meets The Bachelor. Because in the first book, there's not too much of like the
Nobody's
outside.
Dying?
Nobody's dying yet in the first book.
Oh, but that happens later on. Okay.
Yes, it's implied. It's like sort of like a war raging outside. But it's very much like a group of girls come and fight for the prince's heart. But the girl that he really likes also has a lover at home. So love triangle back again.
Yeah. And I have read the selection. I read the first one, and I think I was kind of annoyed by this because it ended on such a cliffhanger. It was very clearly like, we want you to buy the next book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I think it's the same with the second. It's like, at the end of the first, they're down to four girls. The second, I think they're down to two. And then the final one, I think, is about that main character.
Did you read all of them?
Nope. Only read the first one, but, you know, I did a little bit of research on the books because I was like, do I want to keep reading them?
So I know this is my criticism of these guilty pleasure books, which I read a lot of them, is I find that they're kind of formulaic sometimes. And then you read the first one and you really, it's a series. And I know that's intentional because obviously they want to sell books. But I feel like then it's kind of, you know what the second book is going to be like a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any series that you guys want to argue and defend against that you think are not like this? That we would put in a guilty pleasure category? Like The Hunger Games? Would you guys disagree?
Oh, that's kind of good. I feel like the good thing I would argue against with The Hunger Games is that it has the bittersweet ending where it's like, yes, they're together, but nothing is like purely good. So I think that every once in a while a series surprises you that way.
Like the Allegiant, like the Divergent series is also like that, right? Because that had a very controversial, the third book, people were really mad at how that ended.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I'm not going to say how it did because I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but it was very controversial when that happened. There's two books on here by John Green, The Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns. Who, Jesus, can you tell us a little bit about those?
I haven't read either of them, but I've so they're both like very, very sad books, kind of for teenagers,
very teenage angsty,
young love, relationships, that kind of thing. But with a lot of like, I think they both have really sad endings,
right? But you don't want to give those away.
No.
Okay.
But I think they do somehow. I think a lot of teenage books are kind of criticized because everything is so life and death and everything is so extreme.
They're very dramatic.
Yes. But I think that kind of captures what the teenage experience is like. Your social life, your dating life, that is life or death when you're in high school.
And so do you think that authors that write that, I mean, do you think it's an interesting thing, right? Because most YA novels are written by adults, right?
Yes.
I guess Veronica Roth might be an exception. When she started the Divergent series, she was still at Northwestern. So I think she was still in college, right? She was maybe 20 or 21. And it is an interesting thing to think about authors and how they are sort of writing for kids, even if they're not. Yeah. So let's go to, there's a couple other ones. Which other ones haven't we covered on the list here?
One of my like guilty pleasures, and it was almost like an obsession, was the Pretty Little Liars series, which is
like the ABC Family series.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's a TV show, but it's also,
it was based
books.
On the books.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And that truly for me is like absolutely guilty. Like I feel guilty when I read them because they really are. The plot lines are so bad and it's like a hot mess, but it's still like a really fun read. And there's a lot of like twists and turns, which I enjoy. So
it's entertaining.
Yes.
And you can't figure it out.
Yeah.
And is that important to you when you're reading that it's, even if it's something where you feel like it's a hot mess, does it annoy you if you figured it out?
Yeah, for sure. I love there to be like intrigue, mystery. Not on this list, but I also really enjoy kind of like the Gone Girl, the Girl with the Train, Girl on the Train, kind of like a mystery, a suspense thriller.
I think Gone Girl is a really interesting one because somehow I missed like all of everybody reading it and I still didn't know what happened. And when I read it, I just read it a year ago. I was just sort of floored when it gets to the point where, well, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but well, if people haven't, but there's sort of a big twist right in halfway through the book. And I really did not see that coming. So I don't know. Would you guys put Gone Girl in a guilty pleasure on that guilty pleasure list? Or would you feel like that's like on the cusp?
I think it's on the cusp. I think it's a guilty pleasure if you say like, oh, it's one of my favorite books. It's such great literature. I think if you truly feel that way, you maybe feel a little guilty about that. I really enjoyed it, but it's so popular and it's so kind of, I feel like everyone's read it. So it's hard to say it's a true like guilty pleasure.
Yeah, the movie brought it forward and kind of made it not a guilty pleasure anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe sometimes that happens with the movies. Okay, we're going to take a break. We're speaking to Jesus Espinoza, Anna Lapp, and Rachel Brandel. They are part of the student chapter of the American Library Association. We made Goodreads. There's Goodreads lists for the books. If you are follow us on Twitter, you can see all of that as well. Our handle is 21STShow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All summer, we've been compiling reading lists for you. So far, we've done a general one. We've done kids' books. Today, we're doing guilty pleasures. In a couple weeks, we're going to be doing science and science fiction. We're also going to be doing politics and Illinois authors. If you have suggestions for topics that you would like us to do, you can email us. Our email is books@21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. You can tweet them as well to our handle, which is the same thing, 21stshow, so 21st show. And right now, my guests in studio with me are three people from the student chapter of the American Library Association, Rachel Brandel, Jesus Espinosa, and Anna Lapp. Let's go through really quickly, before we wrap up here, your last three books that you guys wanted to talk about. Anna, you picked To All the Boys I've Loved Before by Jenny Han. What's that about?
That's another YA novel, but it's really fun. The idea is that every time this girl gets a broken heart, she writes a letter to the person that she's loved, even if they didn't know that she loved them. And then one day, all of these letters get dispersed, and they all get them. So then she has this entire, like, chaos on her hands.
Is this just email gone wrong?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So she has to deal with each of the boys individually and talk about them. But something she learns is it's not necessarily a bad thing to deal with the things that she's been feeling.
That's a great premise. I like that. And Jesus, you picked, and this is one of my favorite television series of all time, and I've never gotten into the comics, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes. So the comics kind of pick up where the show left off, and they're really a continuation of the show and an expansion of that, the whole like Buffyverse.
So that's actually after the television series ends.
Yes.
And who did Joss Whedon, did he write these comics?
Yes, so he's one of the main writers, and there's kind of a host of different writers that participate in the different comics throughout the years, but he's kind of like the main lead on them.
And is it a comic or a graphic novel? Or is it maybe... No.
I always have the hardest time telling the difference, but okay, I think it's a comic.
And is it still going on? Or
Yes. So there's...
That's a long time. So that's been going on for, I would say, at least 10 years? Mm-hmm. Or how
yes.
long?
So the show is seven seasons, and it's continued, I guess, three more seasons in comic form.
Wow. Okay. Rachel, what's your last pick?
Something Borrowed by Emily Giffen.
And this is a trilogy, and this was also made into a movie.
Yes, which I haven't seen. I forgot that it was made
into
a movie.
It's not that good. I think the books are better, actually.
Oh, okay.
Well, you guys can disagree. Have you read the books?
No.
Okay. See, that's what. Okay. So, Rachel, tell us about the books.
Well, you gotta kind of start it with the rule that every girl knows is you don't date your best friend's BFF or best friend's fiance. You don't fall in love with him. You definitely don't sleep with him. Well, that's what ends up happening to Rachel. She confesses to her best friend Darcy's fiance and finds out that he actually feels the same about her. And you would kind of think that they would fight the feelings, that they would try their best to continue living this life and making sure that her best friend is happy. But they realize that they have, it's kind of like that Mulan thing. You have an honor to your heart as well.
Yeah. And so actually what I really like about this is that I think that this is a great one to wrap up our conversation because I think I've read all of them, and there's even like a prequel. Do you know there's like a prequel that's like Darcy's Diary or something that came out? Yeah, you should read that. But what I like about it is that I think they're very emotional in a good way. I find them bizarrely cathartic books to read, and I'm not quite sure why, but I just think it's not necessarily great writing, but there's something about the experience of this that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you're figuring out another side about yourself because you would think, oh, I would hate this person. She fell in love with her best friend's fiance. What a horrible person. And you start to realize, well, she kind of is in the right as well. And it makes you question how you feel about things.
Thanks so much. That's Rachel Brandel. She's a student librarian. She's a treasurer of the American Library Association student chapter, along with the vice president of the chapter, Jesus Espinosa, and their social media manager, all student librarians, Anna Lapp. Thanks, you guys. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hey, in about an hour, we wanted to let you know that Rock Island native Madison Keys is set to play her next Wimbledon match. She's playing Alizé Cornet of France. She's now the 9th-ranked women's tennis player in the world. Good luck, Madison. We're all cheering for you here in Illinois. To wrap up today's show, Facebook recently sent a friend suggestion to a man. Not that big of a deal, right? But in this case, the user said the suggestion may have been based on a visit to an anonymous gathering for parents of suicidal teens. Facebook suggested he friend a parent who was also in the meeting. That raised all sorts of questions about privacy and disclosure, so he took them to a reporter for Fusion, the news organization. That reporter is Kashmir Hill. She's the Real Future editor of Fusion.net and joins us on the line from San Francisco. Hey, Kashmir, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So this guy saw this friend request from a parent at a meeting you'd presume would be anonymous. What did Facebook say about whether or not they were using his phone location or both of their phone locations to suggest friends?
So I reached out to Facebook last week and explained, you know, what had happened. And their response was initially, well, yes, a smartphone location is one of the signals that goes into the friend suggestion module, which they call People You May Know. Which I was surprised by because it seemed like there were so many obvious privacy problems with something like that.
Let's just, before we get into what Facebook has said since, what other privacy problems do you foresee with a situation like this? Because I think some people might think, well, that's relatively innocuous. You have the location turned on Facebook. It's suggesting people who are near you. You raise a lot of interesting points in your article about how this could end pretty badly for some people.
Well, I mean, some obvious use cases are basically unmasking people, telling you the names of people that you wouldn't have otherwise known. So if you went to, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous, and everyone there was suggested to you as a friend the next day on Facebook with their full names and their profile information, that would be problematic. Or say if you went to a bar and you know, there was someone there that was hitting on you and you weren't interested in that person, but the next day Facebook offered up, you know, your full identity to that person in the form of a friend suggestion. There really are a lot of ways in which you might not want Facebook to surface online, you know, your movements offline.
So Facebook did tell you initially that they were using location services to suggest new friends, but then what happened?
So I published the story. Everybody got very upset about this. And then a few hours after I published it, Facebook actually reached back out and said, there was some confusion here. And actually, we're not using location for friend suggestions. We did a test briefly last year for 4 weeks where we did do this, and now we've stopped.
So Facebook says it's not using location services to suggest friends.
It claims now that it does not. And you know, I asked, you know, there's some ways that you can figure out location that wouldn't involve having the GPS coordinates from the smartphone. So I asked about those. I said, well, are you using IP addresses? Or are you looking at people who have used the same Wi-Fi network? And they said, no, we're not using location at all, which just seems strange to people, because I have come across so many anecdotes of people who are convinced that location explains the friend suggestions that they're seeing.
Before we get into kind of the philosophy of this, right, Kashmir, because you report on all of this, and it's sort of this age-old question as we're using these free apps, how they're using our information and how they're monetizing it, and how we kind of are willingly, obviously, giving them a lot of information. You kind of walk people through in your story, if they're worried about this, what they can do. What can they do with their settings on their phone, for example?
Oh, sure. So even if Facebook isn't using location for friend recommendations, it does use location for other things. It uses it, for example, to see which stores you go to. So it can tell advertisers if they've put an ad on your Facebook page whether you went to that place. And they're using it to allow advertisers to geotarget you. So, for example, some pro-life groups were targeting people who were at abortion clinics with pro-life apps using Facebook. Location being made available to advertisers. So if things like that bother you, you can go to your privacy settings on the iPhone and then go to location settings and turn off Facebook's access to your location. On Android, you have to go to the Facebook specific settings, and then you can turn off location there.
Do you think a lot of this is really about people not necessarily knowing what they're signing up for and agreeing to when they're using services like Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hard thing in today's world is that you just don't understand the information flows. So when you sign up for Facebook or you put the application on your phone, you don't know.
You're not reading the terms of service, first of all,
yeah.
Right? Like, no one's reading through the 50-page terms of service agreement that you just click to agree.
Right. You don't know exactly what they're going to get access to. So a lot of people don't know that when you give Facebook access to your contacts, for example, your email contacts or your phone contacts, that they then use those to make friend recommendations. And not just your own contacts, but if other people have you in their contacts, you know, Facebook will figure out that you know them. So there's just the other, there's a lot of things today that we create so much data, and we just don't know when companies are using it, who has access to it, and kind of how we see it surface in terms of the offers or the recommendations that are made to us.
I wonder what your personal philosophy is about all of this, because this is an issue that you cover. You cover technology, so I imagine you have to also use all of these apps and different social media sites. What's your personal philosophy of how much information you share?
I certainly am probably more paranoid than the average person, though I do think that everyone should be a little bit paranoid in the world that we live in. I do try to live these things because I want to know how normal people have their information exposed. So, I have actually given Facebook access to my location just so I can see what it does to my friend recommendations. But there are some things I'm more careful about. I use an encrypted messaging app, for example, to send messages to people, especially to sensitive sources. It's an app called Signal. I have encrypted email if people want to reach out to me that way. I do have a sticker over my laptop camera, and I really think that everyone should.
Why should everybody have a sticker over their laptop camera? Which even Mark Zuckerberg, that was the story this week, right? Of Mark Zuckerberg using tape to cover his computer camera and microphone?
It is. There are there's hacking software that can be put on your computer that lets a hacker take over your whole computer or just your laptop camera. And it's not just hackers. It's happened to people who had rent-to-own computers. The company that rented the computers to them was spying on them through the cameras if they supposedly hadn't paid their bills. Schools that give laptops to students have access to this camera. So it's just a way for somebody to take intimate photos of you because, we don't think about whether we shouldn't have our clothes off in front of our computers or not have sensitive conversations around our computers. So, it's not crazy. It's really not crazy to put a sticker over that camera.
That's Kashmir Hill. She's the editor of the Real Future Technology section at Fusion.net, joining us from San Francisco. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That's all the time we have for today. On Monday, we've got a special 4th of July edition of the 21st for you. We've been talking about what the American Dream means today as part of our participation in the National ReDream Project. We're going to be broadcasting a live taping that we did at the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul. So tune in on Monday for that. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Travis Stansel with assistance from Howla Delahi and Ben Thomas Payne. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. One of the reasons I think it's really important for us to say credits is so that everyone listening can realize how much incredible work goes into the show every day. And there are so many people apart from me who make this show possible. And one of our team is leaving today. Assistant Chief Engineer Walt Strogoff is one of the key people you never get to hear on air, but none of our broadcasts could make it to air without him. He's the guy who installs and maintains our phone systems to put people on the air remotely and when you call in. He's the person who knows how to find the emergency satellite feed when the White House feed stops in the middle of a broadcast. That has happened to us. He even literally rebuilt our studios. Walt has also played a special role in helping deliver the 21st live to all of our partner stations. He's leaving us to join Nebraska Educational Telecommunications as their new Engineering Division Director for Media. And while we're all immensely sad to say goodbye to him, we know that public media is still in capable hands, and we're really happy that he's staying within public media. On behalf of the entire 21st team, a heartfelt thank you to Walt. As always, he's trying to stay as far out of the spotlight as possible right now. He's in the corner of the control room, but we wanted to thank you and wish you well. I'm Nyla Boudou. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great, safe, and happy 4th of July.